Thank you for having me. Nice to see everyone. And, already some friendly faces. Hopefully they won't turn unfriendly as the evening goes on. I'd been talking quite a bit over the weekend about the music that I've been recording, and so I'm going to play a tune or two later. I'm a little talked out, having spent 2 days leading workshops. But I thought I would actually sort of do two things. Talk a little bit about this confluence of paths that we've been working with this weekend, and then actually talk about step 12, which I didn't get to over the weekend, really. So this can be the final chapter, the final frontier, shall we say. But I think that was a Star Trek reference, but I'm not sure. I thought I would talk about this, the connection between Buddhism and the 12 steps or in recovery, partly just for those who are not familiar with that, and so they would have some idea why we're even bothering to talk about those things together and what it's all about. And I think one of the things that for me is important about this connection is that I feel that the two traditions inform each other in some very constructive ways. So obviously the 12 steps were originally about dealing with alcoholism. And over the decades since, I think it was 1939, the first literature was published, the so-called Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They've been applied to many different issues, different addictions, substance addictions, ranging from drugs to smoking to sex. And, well, I guess that's not a substance, is it? To what you call process addictions, like codependence. And there's Emotions Anonymous and all sorts of things. I'm working on Golf Anonymous myself, developing that. I will be having a meeting out at the club on the 19th hole where we won't be drinking, so it'll be complicated. And Buddhism, of course, was what can I say? The Buddha was, his central question was, how do I get out of here, basically? Once he came to the realization that sickness, old age, and death were inevitable in life, he kind of said, well, I don't really want to have to keep doing this, which at the time and as traditional Buddhists still believe, that we keep getting reborn over and over. And, he thought, well, it's really kind of unpleasant after all, these lives. People seem to think they're having a good time, but when you really explore moment by moment, there's this quality called dukkha, suffering. Nothing's ever quite right. We're never quite there. We're always thinking that we're just about, often thinking that we're just about there. Sometimes we're thinking that we're far away from there, but we will eventually get there if we just keep struggling and doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing and stealing what we need. Or however, we would get there, but we're never there, clearly. We never arrive at a permanent satisfaction. And so he was looking for a way to escape that cycle, which isn't quite the way that we usually present Buddhism in the West. And I hope I'm representing it properly. That's my understanding of it, of this of his story. The 12 steps are about getting out of a different cycle, but a similar one, the cycle of addiction, which is also a constant striving for satisfaction, which is never achieved, and always inevitably results in more suffering, in worse suffering, and just increases, increased suffering and frustration. The Buddha defined the cause of this problem as the craving for things to be different. And this was a switch, a reverse, because our normal perception is we're looking out at what we want and we're reaching for that. And what he did was turn around and say, it's not that you don't have that thing, it's the reaching that's the problem. Just stop reaching, stop striving, stop grasping after. And so this is essentially the same problem of the addict. It's not, the substance isn't the real problem. The behavior that isn't the real problem. It's the sense that I have to get something. It's the feeling that it's not right. And so, both paths kind of propose solutions. The Buddha's solution was, I guess I just put it this, I want to make this kind of simple, so. But that to just keep looking and trying to refine your capacity for looking until you see the truth so clearly that you can no longer be fooled by this illusion that there's something out there. If we keep looking and see how this doesn't work, eventually we'll snap. And have a breakthrough called enlightenment. And that there is a transformative experience which actually allows us to let go utterly and give up this search for satisfaction which never comes. And in that letting go, that there is absolute freedom, nirvana, the fire that's gone out, which is the actual literal translation of nirvana or nibbana. The 12 steps take somewhat of a different route, but they start also with a profound surrender to the truth of the unsatisfactoriness of our addictive behavior and of the uselessness of attempting to control it, that we really can't control it. And then they say that we have to engage in a spiritual path, which isn't defined in the way that, whereas the Buddha laid out techniques and practices, there are a few practices that the 12 steps lay out, but the 12 steps weren't so much trying to define the specifics, but rather outline the form of the process. And this is where I think we can draw parallels. So in the 12 steps, we say that we need to see that there is potential for, I'll just say, for freedom, and that means freedom from addiction, but freedom, a spiritual kind of freedom, and that we need to commit to that. We need to find a path. So the 12 steps use this theistic language, turning our will and our lives over to the care of God, But if we look at that as a process rather than a specific, and move a little bit out of the language, we can see that that means a devotion or a commitment to a path, which is what in Buddhism we call taking refuge. And in the Buddhist texts, whenever someone gets really turned on by the Buddhist teachings, they say, "I go to you for refuge." And so there's a sense of the Buddha offering protection. And of course, it's not a literal protection, but it's this awakened mind or awakened viewpoint that provides protection, because it's only by being awake that we can protect ourselves from these inclinations of greed, hatred, and delusion that lead to suffering. So the 12 steps put this, as I say, in theistic terms, but we can see that they're getting at the same idea, that we need to throw ourselves into this. We need to abandon our past way of engaging the world, that constant striving for pleasure, satisfaction, ego gratification, and find another path which will purify the heart, clarify the mind, clear the mind. Now, in the 12 steps, once this commitment has been made, we're asked to do this deep personal exploration into the ways we have harmed others and the ways that we, our kind of inner turmoil and conflict and our habitual self-destructive and other destructive thoughts, words, and actions. It's called a moral inventory. And that process is meant to be a revealing which allows for a letting go. So to see, we can say it's kind of a karmic inventory, to see how we have developed these patterns, or see what these patterns are, and then begin to work at abandoning them and changing them. In the Buddhist path, well, I don't see the Buddha exactly outlining this kind of a form. It seems somewhat inevitable that once we engage in a deep practice of meditation, that we will come face to face with these inner demons, in the Buddhist tradition called the Mara, the tempter. And we can, so we could characterize something like the five hindrances as these demons, which are in Buddhism, these are seen as less personal than this moral inventory, but the parallels are pretty much the same. That we're just uncovering the particular manifestation of our hindrances, our greed, hatred, and delusion, these poisons, as the Buddha calls them. And in the 12 steps, we go on then to try to make amends, to heal our relationships, eventually arriving at step 12, which says we have a spiritual awakening. And here we find more parallels with Buddhism. In the 12 steps, it says, having had a spiritual awakening, well, I shouldn't skip over step 11, which suggests that one meditate. And of course, that's the most direct correlation with Buddhism. And it's the reason why many people, one of the main reasons why many people who go to 12-step programs turn to Buddhism at some point when they want to learn meditation, because the 12-step programs don't teach meditation. They just suggest that you do it without very much guidance. Again, kind of just giving a framework. And I think that this is an important point that sometimes gets missed. Some people think of the 12 steps as being sort of a complete system, and I don't think they are. I think they can function that way for some people, but they're very open and inviting us to bring in other specific practices that can be applied to this process. So particularly with step 11, that says we should sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. So if we put that in other terms, we could say that we seek to be more present, to be more awake. So in step 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics or addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So when we look at the Buddha's story, you know, he was on this path and, you know, he started out, and really for quite some time we could say he pursued it in quite a single-minded way, but also in quite a selfish way. He abandoned his wife and son, who was just an infant, to pursue his path. And not the first man to leave his family with some higher purpose in mind. But clearly he wasn't... I mean, you know, it can be justified, and I'm sure the texts do justify it, but if we take it from a strictly just the facts, ma'am, viewpoint, he wasn't really thinking about others at the time. He was thinking about himself. And he went off and practiced and became actually somewhat of a celebrity. And he was invited by his teachers to step up and be a teacher with him. And he was, being of royalty himself, when he would enter towns, he was known as Prince Siddhartha. And so he encountered some other royalty who were very interested in what he was doing and asked him, well, when you have your breakthrough, please come back and tell us about it. And meanwhile, then he eventually wasn't satisfied with his teachers and what they taught him. And so he kept going and became, from what we can read from the text, rather obsessive about his behavior. Now, I hate to call the Buddha an addict, but he certainly was anorexic at one point. And, he was doing this with the best intentions, but it wasn't healthy. He said that he got so thin that if he touched his navel, he'd be able to feel his backbone. And that he did so much sitting meditation that his butt became like the hoof of a camel. Rather attractive, I can imagine. eating one grain of rice a day. So there's a lot to... he's obviously a hero to most people, but... I think he had problems, but it's good that he solved them because it helps all of us. And he had his five friends who I don't know, see any mention of them starving themselves to death, but they apparently thought that he was going to become enlightened, and so they figured if he became enlightened, they'd learn from him. So they kind of let him take the lead on that. And so when he eventually decided, starving myself to death probably won't achieve enlightenment, because there was this idea apparently, and I think it's still extant in India to some extent, that somehow the body is this impure, and that if we weaken the body, the spirit will be free, or something nonsense like that. Which is actually, we see this in Catholicism too, whipping ourselves and all these sorts of things. But... when he decided that he needed really to have enough strength to sit up, because he was getting to the point where he was apparently falling over when he would try to meditate, his followers said, the five ascetics said, well, he's gone soft on us, so forget it. So he went off on his own. you know, and the story of him sitting under the Bodhi tree, and whether it was for a night or a week or a month, whatever it was, he had this breakthrough. Well, I'm getting there to what the connection is with step 12, so trust me, I know what I'm doing here. He has this breakthrough, and you can well imagine what the experience would be. Well, maybe we can't imagine, but we can imagine that we can imagine what the experience would be like. That he's had this breakthrough, and you know, he's a very good meditator, and he's just sitting there in absolute bliss and nirvana, just like nothing. There's no fire burning anymore. He's just utter peace, the ultimate peace, absolute peace. And the thought crosses his mind very slowly. Big words. If I try to teach this or explain this to anyone, they won't understand. And it will be a bother. I mean, you know, if you try to teach somebody something that's beyond them, they get, oh, geez, don't bother me with that. That's your, you know, he was just thought it would be an annoyance to try to teach this profound truth that he had realized. Well, we can see this as just a natural reaction, or we can see it as arrogance. Because along comes a Brahma god. In those days, they were hanging out. And says, there are a few with just a little dust in their eyes. In other words, come down off your high horse and, you know, help people out. Now, at least that's how I interpret what he was saying. It was probably more polite than that. But nonetheless, you know, from our perspective of there aren't Brahma gods, we would sort of interpret this as the Buddha had another thought, which was, oh, well, maybe there will be some people who can get this. So this is the moment where he realized that, you know, sitting there in bliss was all very well, but he really needed to be of service. And so he set out and to walk the dusty roads of North India and share his message for 45 years. And it was said that each morning he would awaken and with his divine eye look out to see who within a day's walk was ready to hear what he had to say, who had just a little dust in their eyes. And then he would walk and find this person and preach the Dharma. Or if it was the rainy season, they would come to him. But this is the same message we're getting that the 12 steps say. When we have a spiritual awakening, there's really nothing more to do for ourselves. What more is there to do for ourselves? And part of the spiritual awakening is the realization that we are not separate. That what we have experienced can be experienced by others, and that that it's just a natural outflowing of compassion and care. And I love that idea because it once more kind of undermines self and self-centeredness and ego. Like, I'm going to become enlightened. I mean, first of all, even a statement like that is so contradictory, since where is the I that's becoming enlightened? It's not even a logical statement. But also just seeing that, how can you be enlightened if it's about I? How enlightened is that? It's really a perfect resolution to the spiritual path in the oxherder pictures in Zen, after the monk has gone to the top of the hill and become enlightened, the end of the pictures is him coming back to the marketplace,
riding the ox.
I don't know Zen. Right, you're the Zen guy. I heard that. Thank you. So riding the ox represents that he's riding the Dharma. And so the last part of the 12 steps is, which I love, is practice these principles in all our affairs, which means there are no loopholes. Don't bother to look for them. The point is not to have moments of being, you know, sober or being spiritual. It's to live the life. Just as in Buddhism, we are trying to be mindful continuously. We're not just trying to get good at sitting on a cushion. We're trying to bring this spiritual experience into every moment of our lives. This is the what needs to open up. You know, when I was a kid, we went to church on Sundays. Just sort of, well, one day a week I'll be spiritual, you know. The rest of the time I'll just do whatever I want to do. It makes no sense. Really not very fulfilling. And it was that was another thing that really drew me to Buddhism. When I first learned meditation, I learned TM. It's a lovely practice, but and I was not sober at the time, so I didn't get the most out of it that I might have. Difficult to meditate when you're half stoned or whole stoned, but anyway. But what I understood of what I was taught was, well, just do this 20 minutes twice a day, and eventually you'll achieve universal consciousness or something like that. And after a while with that, I kind of felt like, well, what am I supposed to do the rest of the time? And when I discovered Buddhism and it started to talk about being mindful each moment, and then it talks about right action and right livelihood, right speech, besides the mindfulness and concentration, and then it seemed like, oh, this makes more sense. This applies to my whole life. The hindrances weren't just something that happened on a cushion. I think that for any spiritual practice to be meaningful, it needs to be something that we can live 24 hours a day, or at least 16 hours a day while we're awake. Can't really do much in the dream, so at least I haven't developed that skill. So there you are then, little encapsulation of something, some kind of connection between these two paths. It's, you know, in a way they seem so, you know, when I engaged the 12 steps after having practiced Buddhist meditation for a few years, it seemed like something completely, they seemed completely different to me. I couldn't see any correlation. And I'm always surprised when people come up to me and say, oh, when I saw the 12 steps, I thought, oh, they're so Buddhist. I'm always like, well, good for you. Didn't see that myself. It took me quite some years before I saw that. But I do think what I've come to believe is that any authentic spiritual path must have some kind of arc that is sort of fundamental, that's maybe primal, you know, that isn't really about that culture that it comes out of or that form that it takes, but because a spiritual path is a manifestation of really an expression of a human potential. And so in different cultures and at different times, it takes different forms, but it's always expressing this kind of arc coming from darkness to light, from confusion to wisdom, and from closed-heartedness to openness and compassion. Well, I think that's good. Got a little time. So, should we go till 9? And no, I thought maybe take a couple of questions, and then before I start to drive them away with the music.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe if there are a couple of questions. We could take those. And, yeah.
Kevin, do you ever feel that there should be a 13th step?
Oh, there is. It's hitting on the newcomers. That's the third. That's instructing. Yeah, that's quite a fine tradition. Yeah.
I meant
but,
a step to help people. Thank you. I have a brother who's actively back in Ontario involved in a 12-step program. He goes to 5 meetings a week, and he's been sober now for.
Oh, you think he's addicted to the 12 steps?
20 years or so. He eats, lives, breathes, sleeps, 12-step program. Mm-hmm. And there, he meets in the daytime when he has a chance to meet some of his cohorts. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's wonderful for him because he was not a nice drunk. But I just wondered if sometimes there should be a 13th step where they could
let go of that.
Let go of something. I don't know.
I don't know either. I think different people... you know, approach it, use the program in different ways. I mean, in a way, to me, it is a beauty in the fact that it's always there for you and that there's this really powerful social component to it, social support. A friend of mine who practiced with Goenka many years ago in India, you know Goenka, this was back in the early days, like early 70s, maybe I think about 1970, 71, she said that there was a gang of them. This was, you know, Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Westnisker, and this was, and she said that, you know, they kept showing up at his retreats, and after the third or fourth retreat, he said, "Didn't you people get it yet?" You know. So, there's the process, the initial process of healing, and then there's the maintenance, and there's different forms that maintenance can take. I mean, most of my maintenance now is in this setting, in the Buddhist setting. I don't go to many meetings, though I still consider myself a member. And I can imagine a time when I might want to go to more meetings again. What concerns me isn't so much someone going to a lot of meetings, as long as they have... even if they don't have anything else in their life, it doesn't concern me too much. What concerns me more is when people are rigidly attached to a kind of fundamentalist approach to the steps. That kind of and sort of says that this is the only way you can stay sober, and that happens sometimes with the kind of hardcore AA folks and I guess other programs too, but I totally understand and sympathize with your question about that, but I don't want to take a stance from this position about it. There's lots of things I will be critical of from up here, but
that's not
today. I'll think about it. Yeah, hi.
I think the answer to that was the missing step that he already covered.
The missing step that I already covered?
That's the
10th step. The 11th step is meditation. Yeah. What do you mean?
You said it wasn't there. I think that's would change the result.
You mean then people wouldn't go to so many meetings? I'm not sure. I'm not.
Right. Yeah, the problem transforms. I've known a lot of people who came out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, that is one of the reasons why I got into this work, because I saw that very few people were practicing meditation, and they would have 11th step meetings that were supposedly about meditation or sort of about prayer and meditation, because that's sort of the full 11th step, and there'd be a 5-minute period of meditation. And then there'd be an hour and a half of discussion. And I'd be like, they don't seem to quite be fully engaging in the meditation part here. And then the discussion would be all about how they didn't know how to meditate, or they thought had too many thoughts, they couldn't meditate. And so it did become apparent to me that I had something that a lot of these people didn't have. And it's true that we know that this practice brings kind of a level of serenity and insight sensitivity, inner sensitivity as well as outer sensitivity, but especially inner sensitivity that doesn't necessarily come from working the 12 steps in their traditional form. Yeah, it would be interesting if Bill Wilson had lived a couple decades longer. People like to say things like, I think Bill Wilson would have been a Buddhist, or really was a Buddhist underneath, whatever. If you don't know, he was the founder of AA, one of the founders, one of the two founders. But I do think that he would have been interested in what we're doing, because he was a very curious person, really always looking for different experiences, including trying LSD, which he thought might be a cure for alcoholism. It was actually used in the early 60s as a treatment. I actually was with a psychiatrist when I was a teenager who was treating alcoholics with LSD. I don't know how that...
Stendroff?
What?
Stendroff?
No, this was somebody on the East Coast. And I don't know how that worked out. He committed suicide eventually, though, so maybe not so good for him. But anyway, I always like to bring in cheerful results. Yes?
What about if you have somebody in your life who doesn't want to give up their addiction?
Uh-huh.
And says they want to be spiritual and want to fight that way, but they're struggling with their home, with their friends who are all it's really hard to watch if you cannot feel.
Yeah.
You know, how do I be at peace, be comfortable, or somehow be patient? Because I found my advice so far is not helpful.
Well, that's kind of something of what the Al-Anon program is meant to be there for. We can't control others, and it can be very painful to watch people we love harm themselves or destroy themselves. And it's not uncommon. I mean, I'm an example of someone who, wanted to pursue a spiritual path while not sober. And, there are parallels between addiction and spirituality. The addict is also looking for transcendence. The addict has a longing for fulfillment, to be filled, and it's kind of like a misguided spiritual search. In fact, Christina Grof has a book on that topic called The Thirst for Wholeness. She's actually a recovering alcoholic and talks about how addiction and alcoholism is partially this longing for wholeness, as she puts it. This is one of the toughest issues, and I hear fairly often from parents who are dealing with addicted or alcoholic children who they're trying to help, and it's tricky. We want to be available to them, but if we are supporting them too much, we're enabling them. But it can be terribly frightening to cut them off, and knowing that they might not make it. It just doesn't all come back to what I'm doing, but certainly my book, One Breath at a Time, was meant to reach people who couldn't respond to the traditional 12 steps, but who might see through, partly through my story and through my way of explaining things, that both that, yeah, what they're doing isn't really working, and that recovery could actually be appealing, you know, kind of depicted in a way that it's not just like going into a church basement with a bunch of guys in raincoats and drinking stale coffee, you know, that there's some real joy and a real life that's engaging and interesting, you know, and that the 12 steps don't have to be sort of an insult to the intelligence, that, you know, they don't, that there's a way to understand these ideas about higher power that can really be intellectually satisfying as well. So, you know, giving someone my book isn't the worst idea. Yeah. Well, good. And, you know, I hope it's of use. There's obviously it's just a small thing, but we never know what's going to be of help for people, and we want to make just the gestures that can work. I have a nephew who he was living in L.A. when I was there after I got sober, and he was just 14 years younger than me, and so by then he was in his early 20s, and I could see that he had some stuff going on with substances, drugs and alcohol. And I didn't know that if he was an alcoholic or not, but I thought he could be on that path, and certainly there's a lot of that history in my family. So we were going to have lunch, and so I invited him. There was a meeting that I would go to in Hollywood, Fairfax and Hollywood Boulevard in Fairfax, I think it was, on Saturday mornings. And it was full of glitzy Hollywood people and movie stars and attractive people. And there would be like big Harleys out front, and it was just kind of like people in leather jackets. It was like cool, you know. It wasn't like cool, it was cool. And I said, well, meet me up there at my meeting, you know, just so that he would see, oh, that's an AA meeting? You know, wow, there's some babes there. I might want to go there, you know. And eventually he did become a heroin addict, and he got clean, and now he's married and has a 1-year-old. So, and I performed the wedding ceremony about a year and a half ago. So, you know, you plant the little seeds where you can, and remember that as long as someone doesn't die, there's a chance. Sometimes it takes a long time. You know, I mean, it was about probably about 8 years before Nick got clean after that. You know, so good luck.